If you're listening to this right now, thank you very much for clicking. This is the last episode, season finale, the best bits of the Underdog Way podcast all in one single episode. My name is Ruben, and over the past few months, I've been interviewing quite a few people and picking on their journeys, their ideas, and some of the work that they do and sharing it through this podcast. And through that process, I've met some really cool people, had some really cool opportunities come my way, from public speaking engagements to this podcast being nominated for an award at the Podcasting for Business Awards competition in the diversity and inclusion category, which is really, really cool. That's a particular topic that I care quite a bit about and do quite a bit of public speaking around. So thank you very much for supporting this podcast on that journey. And I really love the engagement as well, because when people are querying things, asking things and questioning or just commentating, it does help motivate me to do more, because I know that cool people are receptive and listening to it. Let's give them a bit more of what they want. With this episode, I pulled out some of the best bits from each episode this season. And so it is pretty good. I think I've handpicked 5 to 6 minutes from each episode. So you're going to hear loads of different voices. The podcast will be back in spring, so I'll put out an announcement in March, hopefully release in April. And until then, I'm going to be reaching out to new guests, interviewing, editing, and doing all that kind of jazz. Thank you very much for following this journey. And if you are listening to this now, you can vote for the Underdog Way podcast at the Podcasting for Business Awards. I'll put a link in the description. But if you do miss the deadline, don't worry at all. Fingers crossed that I will get something there. But if I don't, I'm just really happy to be nominated. However, it's just it's an honor to be recognized purely based on the nomination itself and the amazing public speaking opportunities that have come my way as a result of this. It's been a real journey. Thank you very, very much from Ruben Pillai at the Underdog Way podcast.
And I remember Tom Allen just saying really matter-of-factly, he was like, you'll be on it. You'll be on it in a couple of months, 100%. And I remember just thinking, oh, he's just saying that to be polite. And literally about a week later, I'd just come off stage at a truly dreadful, dreadful gig. And I had like loads and loads of missed calls from my agent. And she just sounded really excited on the phone. She was like, don't get overexcited, but Mott the Week have asked if you would be available potentially to do an episode in September. And it was just mad. It was just so mad. But it's really weird. I always imagine, because I was like, that would have, as a comedian, it would have been like my life's ambition. That's what it's all leading up to. So if I managed to achieve that by the age of like 65 and then retired the next day, I'd be happy, because that was like the one thing I sort of wanted to get on. And it was my favorite panel show when I was growing up. And so it was just, it was really weird, but it came with a caveat. Every step came with a caveat. So my agent was like, "The vast of you're available. That might mean they're asking 10 people and they'll choose the best person or the most famous person. So it might not be you." He said, also, these things change. Maybe it's because someone's dropped out and in a couple of weeks' time, they might suddenly say they're available again. So I was very excited, but I was like, I can't tell anyone. And I was at the pub with my friends after this really bad gig. And they were like, "What was the phone call?" And I was like, "I can't say, just in case it sort of doesn't go ahead." And then like a few days later, it started to look more and more clear. And then eventually my agent like received a contract through the post that she had to sign to say I was definitely sort of going to be on it. But there was still no definitive day where it was like, you're definitely on it. There was no like X Factor judges houses moment where they're like, you're going to be on Mott the Week. It was always with this caveat of like, if everything goes ahead, it should be fine. And I remember like on the day of the recording, even thinking like, I bet I turn up and they go, "I'm really, really sorry, but Frankie Boyle's just decided he'd like to go back on the show." And then they'd kick me off. I was so fully aware that would happen. Yeah. And it was just mad. And I was so scared. So scared going into that studio, because it was just on a different, it was just on a different level to anything I'd ever done, because it's filmed in front of I was used to performing in front of like big audiences at comedy clubs and stuff. But Mock the Week not only is filmed in front of a big audience while you're there, but obviously a much, much bigger audience on TV later. And it was really scary knowing that even if you're saying something that gets a laugh in the room, you won't know whether the people of the UK, the viewers of Mock the Week, have enjoyed it until like 3 days later when it actually goes out on TV. And that was weird. The weirdest gap was from the moment filming ended to the moment it actually went out on TV, because for those 3 days afterwards, it's like if you have an argument with someone and you can't think of a good thing to say, and the moment you walk away from an argument, you're like, oh God, I wish I'd said that. Yeah. That was almost like, it was like Mock Week. It was like you walk away afterwards and you're like, oh, I could have said this, I should have said that. So I was really, really scared going. And the nice thing was that I knew everyone on the lineup, and that was that made it a lot nicer. I'd met Dara Breen really briefly, because that Edinburgh Fringe, he'd come to see my Edinburgh show, and that was just crazy. Because
very, very cool. Very,
it was mad. Very cool. Honestly, it was mad, because it was just
he's
weird.
Really funny. Really,
he's
funny.
Amazing. He's amazing.
Really
funny. And in person is just as funny as when he's on stage. But I remember it just really felt wild when I was still on stage and I just watched him walk into the back of the room where I was doing my Edinburgh show, and it felt weird to know that like he's bought a ticket and he said to someone, one ticket to Glenmore please, probably not in those words, but like it felt really mad that Dara Breen has said that, and it just felt completely beyond me. And that Edinburgh Fringe, so I did Mock the Week in September, but that August I've been at the Edinburgh Fringe, and I was doing a show that I was so, so proud of, and to this day I'm so, so proud of, but they just didn't, the audiences just didn't get it. And I think now that I've got audiences who are a bit more sort of like, who know in advance the sort of style I sort of do, the show probably would go down well now. But at the time, it was just going down to not silence every day, but just like mild titters, and then just like, yeah, long periods of just agonizing, just nothingness. And I remember being so, so frustrated. And the first day that I saw like a whole row of people just walk out halfway through, and I really wanted to tell them like, I'm quite good.
Please come back.
I've been booked for Mock the Week next month, but obviously I couldn't say that because I couldn't tell. I wasn't allowed to tell anyone. So it filled me with so much courage when I saw Dara Breen walk in, and the audience. Like I remember watching word get round the audience before the show started. Like Dara Breen's here, and that made the show go amazingly, because I think the audience were like, "Well, Dara trusts this guy, so." Yeah, we'll give him a benefit of the doubt. He must be good.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It was just the effect.
Just that vote of confidence.
Exactly, of just knowing he was sort of there. Yeah. And so that was the one thing that filled me with confidence going into Mock the Week. It was like, right, I've done that. For the rest of my, even if I do badly and I don't even get a single sentence out, I'm just silent for the whole 3 hour recording, I can say for the rest of my life, oh my God, I was on it. And that can never be taken away. That will always have happened.
That's the thing about Black life is like, our lives are different than white folks, right? I mean, that's just, you know, that's just what it is. I mean, we live, we live differently. We have totally different challenges. And what my mother was explaining to me is like, look, you know, I'm just gonna tell you just honestly, look, you're a black child, you're gonna be a black man. So I have to prepare you for what you're gonna face. Look, no kid should ever have to be taught to do certain things to not be killed by the police. Like that's not the way life should be. You know, kids should be able to be, you know, experimenting, doing backflips in the backyard, running around, like, you know,
making mistakes. Exactly, making mistakes.
Yeah, like just living. But see, when you're black, you're just not afforded that opportunity. And so, you know, when my mother gave me that, you know, when she gave me the talk, I was like, wow, oh, okay, so this is what I have to look forward to. And the thing about the talk is it, you know, it's a rite of passage, not only receiving it, but giving it. And so when I gave it to the young man that I was mentoring, I had to let him know, listen, like, this is what's been taught to me. I'm passing this down. Because it's my responsibility to do whatever I can, Ruben, to make sure that the ones that come after me are in a better position. You know, because if I don't do that, then I'm not doing my job. Like, it's like the Spider-Man quote, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And not saying that, you know, I have any power, but I'm just saying that the like any knowledge that I can pass down to ensure or to help you have an easier chance at living than I did is something that I'm 100% down to do. Because if you don't, that's just selfish. You know, something that the great Malcolm X once said, he said, Black people need to start looking at each other as one. Is that if one Black person gets harmed, we all get harmed. And so that's the way that I look at it. My lady always says, be of service. And that's what I'm doing. I'm being of service because, look, I'm a writer, but I'm also a vessel, man. I mean, like, you know, Beanie Sigel, the rapper, once said, anything that came from me is wrong. Anything that came through me is right. And what I mean by, I'm sorry, what he meant by that, I believe, is that what came through him was God. I'm Catholic, and I believe that we are all stewards on this planet to help one another. And it doesn't matter what faith you believe in. I just believe that we are all interconnected. And so I wanted to be able to mentor someone who was coming from a similar situation that I did, because growing up, you know, I didn't have a lot of male role models. You know, my grandfather, you know, who's the greatest man I ever knew. My father, I really didn't meet him until I was 13. And I had another amazing man in my life, Mr. Stan Banks, who was a high school teacher. So I had I had some great men behind me. So it's only right for me to pay that forward, Ruben, you know, and
got it. Yeah.
So yeah, you know, that's what we should do.
Thank you very much for that, Leon.
Sure, yeah, no problem.
Sharing those insights. I have a quote that I want to share with you now.
Sure.
And I just want to get your feedback and your thoughts on this quote.
Yes, sir.
For racism to function in society, everyone has to be functionally miseducated of the human story.
That's interesting. You know, that's something that I'm going to have to sit on, because I don't believe in the ignorance of racism, right? You know how like some people say, you know, white folks are just ignorant. They just don't know. I decline that, right? I don't believe that, because there's so much data out here. See, there's a lot of accounts. Like my account is not different. It's not anything unique. I'm just a young kid from Southside Kansas City. I guarantee you, if you go across the pond, if you go to certain parts of London, Johannesburg, if you go to you know, certain parts of Ireland, I mean, like, you know, like the slums of Dublin, I guarantee you, you will find a young man such as myself. And so with that being said, it's like our condition, our stories are known. So I think that with just my opinion, I think that with racism, one of the reasons why that it keeps perpetuating, Ruben, is because we don't hold people accountable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're like,
completely agree.
It's like our fellow homeboy Ayo, I seen him post something on social media talking about, you know, BAME and how he won't stop talking about the story because it's real. So if he's talking about it, then people have got to know about it. So
yeah,
I don't know if I agree with that, man.
I didn't experience full or authentic Thai, but I experienced enough to know what it's like. And I learn a lot from that, like just the culture. You mainly learn more about the culture, the attitude, like their style, like the food, obviously. You get that family vibe, like you're part of the family, and that with the cultural side and the authentic side.
Did you run and do all the sauna work as well? And
no, I wish
the dehydration process.
Yeah, that's the thing, like, because There was all those Westerners around. I just fought the Westerners at our walk around weight. I didn't have to, because, you know, the tires probably a little bit more strict when the Westerners fight the tires be same weight, and especially for titles and Lumpini titles and that. But at Bangla Stadium, where I fought most of the time, and the other ones that I did have as well, now we just rocked up and fought how we were. So it was we were a lot healthier and had more power, and, you know, we could fight more regularly, because if you cut in weight for fights, you don't want to, you want to, you know, relax after that and get your body back to normal, mind back to normal. Us Westerners fighting is a totally different kettle of fish. Like, that's just a bit of, it's not as much the lifestyle, the Muay Thai lifestyle. It's more tourists having a fight, Westerners that are coming from another country. It's not like the real Muay Thai. But yeah, on the north, it's like just that real authentic thigh versus thigh, gym versus gym. You know, it's about reputation, that's about the money, the gambling. It's serious. And that's where Muay Thai came from. It's going to be like that wherever it is like that. So the north, all of it's like that because not as much tourists. I just think it gets a bit watered down with the Westerners. So you can get a fake gauge of what it really is. You're probably right. The north and the quieter areas, would all you'd see is that real Muay Thai. And yeah, the real stuff is exactly that. They must make weight. It's like a job. The kids just have to do it because, you know, the other kid's doing it as well, and they've signed up for it, and they always make it happen. And you can, like, personally, I've cut weight before twice where I've actually fainted for a second.
Oh, really?
But then I was fine after. Yeah. So your body can take it to a certain level. You're not going to die. You're not going to collapse and die, like, if you're doing it properly. So you can push. You can push. And it is an advantage if you cut the weight.
There was a story a while back of Jordan Coe. He was on a weight cut, and
yeah, he
passed out, and then he passed away.
Yeah, from what I heard,
yeah,
he just didn't have anyone looking after him. I don't know the full story, whether it's true or not. I heard he had an energy drink, like he was drinking 150s while he was fully dehydrated.
But they're quite strong, aren't they? As well,
so that's not going to help you.
No.
It'll give you a bit of energy, but it's not good for.
I can dehydrate you.
It can dehydrate you more.
Yeah,
he was probably already really dehydrated, but he's a good guy. Like,
yeah,
I trained with him a fair few times. I actually don't run as much when I cut weight. I just sit in a salt bath, and I've always got people with me. But in terms of shockwaves for training, yeah, like, it motivated me a lot when that happened, because how such a good guy he is. So yeah, it made me train harder, and I'm sure a lot of people would have been impacted from it.
I was going to ask you actually about the staph infection you got last year.
Is it still a scar there? Or?
I've got a scar there behind the ear.
Yeah.
Wow, because I still remember the plaster you had there, and it was massive.
Yeah. Man, that was unfortunate.
What was your priority at the time?
My priority was to get a warm-up fight in before my fight back home. But once I realized there was a proper hole in my neck, and all it would take is for my opponent to punch it once, no matter who it is. One hit there would probably make a massive chunk come out. Then my priority was my health.
It's incredible as well, because you think back and you think, like, oh, wow, like, kind of, I had that mindset, but then...
Even Jay Tonkin was there around that time.
Yeah.
And he was just, like, looking at the hole in my neck, and he knew that I wanted to keep fighting. I just wanted to fight. And he was, like, telling his mate, see, Jake's crazy. He's like, Jake just wants to fight. Like, and that's Jay, who's had however many fights. And he's like fucking saying that I definitely shouldn't fight. it was definitely unfortunate. Like, I thought that I needed a warm-up fight because I had a big fight and I'd had a year layoff before that. So I thought that I needed the warm-up, but turns out I didn't get the warm-up and I won the fight anyway. That fight was meant to happen, and then because I didn't take that one, they matched me for 2 weeks later. You know, I thought I'd got rid of the staff, and I was meant to fight on Thai Fight 2 weeks later.
Okay.
That would have been the biggest fight of my life. And turned out that, you know, this staff came back, and I had this drink that they drink over there. It's what they drink after a fight to get rid of all the toxins and reset your body. because you build up toxins and stuff with all the adrenaline that pumps uh-huh. through you and whatnot while you fight, and, you, and the blood clots and whatever from the impact. And I drank this drink, and it was a bad time to do it because I still hadn't recovered. Like, this stuff was still in my system. I was still sick. Like, my body was no good. And then I drank this drink anyway. Just like I said before, the beginner's mindset, you listen to your coach. Bang, drank this drink, and it sent me bad. Like, for 2 days, I just couldn't hardly move. Like, I could hardly eat. And I was still going to fight. Like, I felt bad pulling out. But this was the biggest fight of my life. And the guy that I was fighting was this 80-kilo Thai that just knocks everyone out in round one. Like, seriously, just I watched YouTube, and there was, like, 15 videos of him knocking everyone out in round one.
That's not common, is it?
Just like, yeah, yeah, it's that card check with the ropes.
Yeah.
So the punches are
okay. Heavier. Yeah.
I just ended up talking to my trainers back home, and we just pulled the pin, and I came home just because, you know, I needed to get my body right for the proper fight back home. That's what it was all about. And when I got home, everyone was like, "Fuck, you look sick, Jake." But I bounced back within a week and got all the training done and won my fight. So
that's good, really good.
I believe there's a sport out there for everyone. It's just sometimes they're not necessarily the traditional sports that we do at school. They're not necessarily hockey, cricket, netball, things like that. And I guess I've been lucky in that I like grew up doing lots of sports, but always enjoyed it, but never excelled massively in any one particular. And then I went to university and I randomly came across the sport of wakeboarding, and I absolutely loved it, and I picked it up really quickly, and I ended up going on to compete like for GB. The bizarre thing was, like, that came about because of kind of chance, and I could have so easily have never tried that and then never found this passion. And so I think my aim really was for people who maybe didn't like traditional sports at school, or hate the gym, but every January they sign up to the gym,
yep.
and they never end up going because they hate it. And I like the gym, so I've got nothing against the gym, but if you don't like it, then I kind of think go and find something you do like. And that was kind of the idea behind it, was find something bizarre like Quidditch or underwater hockey or fencing, all these like bizarre sports, and to try and show people. And also the whole, you know, the overarching theme of explore and experiment. That was the idea. If you don't know which one you like, go and try loads of them. And it's okay that you won't be good at all of them. You will be actively bad at some of them. And that's okay, because you'll go, okay, I wasn't very good at that. I didn't enjoy that. So with that one. And then you try one and you're like, oh my God, this is it. This is my sport. And suddenly you have all this new motivation. Like, people think I'm really sporty, but actually I am very bad at motivating myself to do sports. But if I find something I like, I am like so focused on it. And I feel like I don't have to, in inverted commas, motivate myself, because it's just an inbuilt passion. And that's what the 100 Sports was about, was trying to help people find that inbuilt passion to do sport. But equally, that idea could apply to anything, not just sport. But that was the example, obviously, in that particular challenge. As a kid, I was very focused, and I was good at achieve. If I set myself a goal, I'd always achieve it. And so now I have this relationship with myself where I can set myself a goal, and if I quit that goal, it's because I've chosen to quit it, that it's not the right goal. But it's not, but I don't beat myself up that, I'm bad, I'm not disciplined, I don't have the focus or the vision or the discipline to achieve it. I've just realized, partway down the route, this isn't the road I want to go down, so I'm going to change direction. Whereas I think if you have that relationship, if you're someone who's not kind of set themselves and achieved a goal in life, you kind of almost have to achieve it to prove to yourself that you can achieve it. Does that make sense? The differentiation between the two. Mm-hmm. But if we can learn that young, we can learn, right, it's not me, it's that the goal's not right. And I think that's a big thing, isn't it? It's like we stick at it because we feel we have to, because otherwise people will think we're
failure or
yeah, exactly. But if it's the right goal, then it's a lot easier to achieve and it'll be a lot more fun, and you won't have to beat yourself up so much to get to the end.
There was a period where I played the keyboard, the guitar and the recorder, and my grandma would always call me a jack of all and the master of none. But then now I think it's the best thing that you have a basic skill in a few things and a basic awareness around your core skills and core sports. I think it helps you to get the best out of life.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And also it's that kind of, I get you with it in terms of the like jack of all, and but equally that's the trying lots. And if something's, when one's right, it will stick and you will kind of, and but equally, I think sometimes we think we, for example, with a musical instrument or with a sport, we can think of, okay, well, you know, someone might say a jack of all, and I've always felt like this, like, oh, I've done, I do so many different things. People will think I'm scatty and I do all this and like
be flaky and inconsistent.
Yeah, exactly. And that I'm a jack of all of them rather than being one. But now over time, I've started to see the pattern that yes, the projects are completely different and they're left and right and all over the place. But what's consistent is the values within them. And I would say I'm now an expert. I'm an expert at throwing myself in and trying different sports, for example, in terms of I am not scared to try any sport, whether I look stupid. So that becomes my niche. But the sport itself, like I don't want to be the world's greatest rower, for example. But I would love to be the world's greatest multi-sports person, for example, as an example. And that difference. And I think it's very, especially kind of parents and at school, it's we have these categories of like, which subject are you best at? Whereas actually where you can make a real difference in the world is when you go, well, I'm pretty good at, like for me, it was like, okay, I like art, technology and maths. Like maths and technology do not go together. But then when I found, and sport as well, that in that whole mix. And then when I realized you could do like sports engineering and like all that kind of stuff, suddenly it was like, there's very few people who do that unique mix of things. So I think that's where the trying different stuff, because you'll find a crossover and then you'll find your unique niche rather than if you were to do pick one sport, for example, to be the best at that one sport or to be the best in like artist is very hard, but be the best kind of artist in sport, that's
your niche now, isn't it?
Exactly, right? So
yeah,
that's where we get the crossovers, and that's where we do, how many new discoveries have there been in examples, but a pure discipline or skill, but where there's big revolutions in design, for example, is when someone sees something in one sector and combines it with something in another sector, and that's when it's different. But you never kind of get anything new from doing the same thing you always did.
This triggered you to start your own business.
Yes, yes, correct. So I applied there. I applied even at Asda, and I didn't even get that job. So then there's only one way around it, and I thought, you know, I just have to do something. I was 23, I was unemployed, I had no social life, I didn't talk to anyone. And those days, it was even harder because we never had Facebook or WhatsApp or anything.
Yeah.
So to physically talk to someone, you had to physically go out the street and talk to them in person, which was something which I never, ever, ever did. So my parents had an empty shop, and they were about to rent it out. And then my mum said, look, if you want, you can have the shop, pay us the rent, and set up your own business. And I was into training then. Again, I started training because I was a bit insecure about myself. So that's a big reason why I started to go gym to increase my self-confidence. And then I thought, I'm going to open up my own business.
And get Hench as well.
Which is part of the benefits. It all happened because I couldn't find the job, so I had to go down my own route. And now there I am 12 years later.
Fantastic. So 12 years means you started in 2007.
2007. Good maths.
Very good maths. In that first year then, like, did you have any specific challenges, any kind of doubts? There must have been time when you thought, crap, is this actually working? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Especially when you first open your business, I was like 7.5 stone. So I wasn't even big. And then customers used to come in and think, you're not big, how can you sell me this? I was like, well, trust me, it'll work. Because I was taking it and I started to get bigger and bigger off it. And There were other shops where there was like big guys behind the counter, and they used to go there. But
yeah.
They've actually all now shut down. As there's only my shop left because I've got that self belief. I knew that it worked, but I did have doubts, obviously, especially the first year when turnover isn't that high, customers don't come in. But it's all about having the absolute self belief and keep on marketing, marketing, marketing. And there we are, 12 years on, and we're still doing all right.
Did you feel that kind of that experience kind of like enabled you to grow as a person as well? Just getting out and actually speaking to people, because this was your business, you had to make it work. This was the way that to pay your bills or to feed absolutely. Yourself. You had to make it work.
We'd put in as a family about 20 grand to open it up.
Jesus.
To buy the stock and, you know, all the like IT systems. It was a big investment. So it had to work regardless. So again, the first couple of months, my stammer was so bad. I hated answering the phones, but I just had to do it. And for years, I've avoided the phone. Like if it rang, I would just ignore it, like back at home. But this was my own business. I knew there was no way we could ever fail because we'd lose so much money. So yeah, it was hard. Eventually I got more confident talking and answering the phones, and then I started to make the phone calls. Before I used to like email all my suppliers. Yeah. I simply tried to avoid the phone, and eventually got the confidence and the courage to literally pick up the phone, dialing and ordering via the phone. So it sounds, it was hard, but it's made me definitely, as you said, like a stronger, more confident person. But you have to go through bad times to appreciate the good times. I've not learned anything.
Yeah.
If I go to North Korea on an 18-hour train, then get searched. My phone got searched. My bag has got searched. My camera's got searched. We got forced to bow down at the dead leader's body. We like saw him there.
Wow. Okay.
It's like it's so militant, and you have to behave. The first time, I've genuinely been scared. Like genuinely been scared. So all I can say, again, if you want to grow, you must get out of your comfort zone.
What was the length of the trip?
It was about 6 days.
Cool.
I was tired after two. Just like mentally. Yeah. It's like, all I can say is like being in prison. We're not even allowed to leave the hotel unless we're guided.
Okay. Did you go as part of like a tour, or was it individually?
No, we're not allowed to go individually.
Okay.
We have to go as part of a tour.
Uh-huh.
So there's about 10 or 15 of us. It was actually a really good crowd. And we were just
thinking it must be because it isn't the typical place to go. So then you end up going with a group, and there'll be interesting personalities in that group.
Absolutely.
Because of the nature of the trip, that attracts those kind of people into the group.
Exactly what we're talking about earlier, about likes attracting likes. So there won't be any people on like an 18 to 30s holiday. It's all just like wanted to go out and get drunk.
Back to the bus and,
This is like serious, like independent tourists who want to go out there and see what on earth is going on.
I can learn stuff basically.
Can learn out there. And do you know who Stuart Pearce is, the footballer?
Sorry?
Stuart Pearce.
Yeah, yeah.
I met him in North Korea.
Really?
I've got a photo of him.
Yes, I saw the picture on Facebook.
Yes. I've met Stuart Pearce in North Korea. I was like, what are you doing here? He's like, I'm just here on tour. So even footballers go there.
That's incredible.
I met Stuart Pearce in North Korea.
Yeah, well, he's probably been to every other country around the world. So
he's not been to North Korea, but he has now.
Well, he has now, yeah.
And he saw me there, so that must have been his highlight.
Yeah.
So,
did you tell him that you met Gaza and
no, because he was busy. I kind of like didn't want us to hold copies. He had like four or five half hour, like, you know, other people on the tour, like having photos with him. He was there with his, I don't know, girlfriend or his wife. So I quickly had a quick photo, said hello, how are you? Then just let him be.
You could have been like, oh yeah, I've got a mate. I think he knows you. His name is Gaza. Then, do you know each other?
I was tempted, but yeah. I'm glad I've got a photo with him, and I'll be uploading more photos on my Instagram and stuff page. But yeah, it's been a...
He's pretty scary, isn't he?
Man. Who, Pierce or Gaza? Or both?
Pierce. Well,
they just called him Psycho.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, yeah. He, like, even therefore, God, I best not, you know, say anything bad. But I said, that's why you have to go out of your comfort zone and grow, because you'll meet so many new people, and it enabled you to grow as well.
So, I mean, everyone that lived in a hot zone, which we either termed it, or areas or different or certain suburbs that were far more risky than others, we made sure that they got relocated with their families. We made sure that they were like that they lived in much safer, you know, areas. Then again, like, you know, this was Syria, it's not Norway. There is, you know, a risk of almost everywhere, but there are areas which became much more riskier than others. So I mean, getting the essentials right, you know, making sure that we're safeguarding the actual physical well-being of our staff and their families first and foremost, that really was, I mean, the cornerstone behind anything else which we did. So once we got that right, made sure that everyone is really living as well as possible in that country, in that context, we started focusing on other things. With time, things become better. So maybe in the first year or so, I found it a lot more stressful. It was like, you know, a completely new world to me. And you maybe like my inclination in the first year or so was maybe not to almost found it like wrong to like, you know, enjoy life for what it has. But then with time, you know, and I think another just me, I mean, people around me, you know, as well in the country started to like, you know, embrace life more. And, you know, I mean, search for these decreasing but still viable windows of pause, of sedivity and normalcy. So just like you're saying, I did get married during the war, at the height of the war. So I decided to settle down, you know, in the most unsettling of times. And I think, you know, this is what people should do more of during, you know, a crisis: search for, you know, I mean, windows of normalcy and try to live their lives as normally as they could. And actually, we realized that people start to appreciate life even more during a crisis, and maybe appreciate the small pleasures much more than they would maybe do during normal times when they're taken for granted. So, I mean, maybe if you or any of the readers or listeners could, you know, I mean, think about the first 2 weeks of the lockdown. So, I mean, mundane things like, you know, going to a cafe, sitting there ordering, you know, a coffee, which weren't, you know, I mean, allowed in that period, probably became a lot more cherished now. And maybe now when you're allowed to go back to a pub, to a restaurant, you find yourself starting to, like, you know, appreciate it a lot more maybe than before. Because, I mean, losing something, even if it's mundane, you maybe start to appreciate it more. So yes, it was stressful, but we did not really, like, you know, with time, you know, we did not let it engulf us. The idea was not to let that feeling of impending doom and very dominant, the dominant negativity to really wash away all of our spirits, because it was very tempting to do so. I mean, it was so much easier to fixate the negatives than, you know, try to find positives and, you know, enjoy life. But I think with time, people become a lot better at. Just because I went through a war don't think in titles me, or really, like, you know, anyone to, like, you know, undermine any other hardship or fear. Any other person's fear and hardship is legitimate. But I mean, if I can say from my perspective, yes, it was hard to be forced to stay home. But what was maybe 1,000 times harder is being forced to leave home. So to me, the most difficult thing was, you know, making that decision to leave home, because, you know, I mean, even if there's a war and even if, like, you know, this was, you know, a crisis that was just becoming worse and worse, and there was an actual threat to my life on a daily basis, you know, it's still home at the end. And it's really, really hard. And I think, you know, it takes a lot for, like, you know, someone to take that active decision to decide to just leave home, get uprooted from where they are and go over and start somewhere else. So, I mean, to me, I was really torn between these two worlds, you know, not wanting to leave home, because eventually it is home no matter what happens. But also, like, you know, I mean, being pragmatic about things. And, you know, in the book, I say that one should pursue opportunities relentlessly and be strategic. And after a few years, my wife and I decided that, you know, it made more strategic sense for our family to be based outside. And it was a very, very difficult choice. Of course, I mean, living in my country, leaving my family, my network, where I was valued the most, leaving the bank, you know, as well, where I think we did a lot of, you know, good things together, leave the teams that I've worked with. It was a very difficult thing, but I think it was the right thing to do. I mean, sometimes you do need to take, you know, I mean, actions that will be difficult, but I think it made most sense to me and my family in the long run.
Like sometime before when we're talking, that your trigger was actually watching School for Stammerers documentary.
Not my trigger. The trigger was Stephanie and Charlie's trigger. Since they watched that program, they were driving me mad.
Did you watch it as well, by any chance?
I watched it.
Yeah.
I did watch it after they drove me mad too.
Yeah.
I refused to watch it at the beginning because I was like, listen.
We were in it, bro.
Yeah.
In the background somewhere.
I know.
How dare you?
And now I refused to watch it because I had the attitude that this hasn't worked for me before. I've tried it. It hasn't worked. I'm not going to try it again. And speech was getting really bad for me, man. So I knew I had to do something. I just didn't know what it was. And I was in such a state where I wasn't really talking at all. I wasn't really speaking much in social situations, in anywhere, restaurants, just at home. I wasn't really having many conversations. So I knew I had to do something about it.
Like, how would you actually describe like speech getting really bad? What does that actually mean to you personally? What does it vividly sound like or look like?
Waking up in the morning and it's the first thing on your mind. Going to bed at night and it's the last thing you think of. Waking up in the morning with chest pains from anxiety. And knowing that no matter what kind of challenge you take on today, you got to do it all over again tomorrow. No matter what fear you face today, no matter how much you achieve, it's never going to end there. You've got to do it all over again tomorrow. And it's just constant worry about how everyone thinks of you, constant worry of people's judgment, looking stupid, looking like you're incompetent, feeling lucky to be in the situation that you are in, whatever that may be, in terms of work, in terms of you don't feel like you really deserve what you have because people have had to ask for it for you or you've had to get it through another means. You couldn't just go and do it yourself. Just pure avoidance. That's what it means to me. Just avoiding everything, hiding away.
And if you didn't like take any action at that point, like where did you see this ending up? Because you made that phone call when you were 28 years old, coming up to the big 30. Where did you see this heading?
I saw this heading in a situation where my sister got really frustrated with me at work, where Stephanie felt like she was doing all the work and I wasn't contributing much. A feeling for me of being given a handout, which I knew wasn't the case when we launched, but I was worried it could develop into it. As the business grows, if I'm hiding away still and we're growing and we're employing more people and there's generally nothing for me to do, what's my role here? If I haven't got a leadership role at all, if I'm not talking to the staff, if I'm not talking to banks or clients or to anyone, what's my role here really? So my main fear was that Stephanie would get frustrated with me because I had a previous business where that happened with a friend. I know working with family is different to friends, but I still know family members that have fallen out of a business and stuff like that. And I knew that me not pulling my weight could make us reach that point. So there was no way that I was going to allow my speech to affect the business, to affect mine and Steph's relationship. And that was the real motivation that I knew the only thing that could stop the PT from working at that point was me, because I knew that Steph had the skills. I knew that I had the skills. I just knew that it was a good possibility that I wasn't going to allow myself to show the skills I had simply because my stutter would make me avoid. Being an entrepreneur is not a fashion statement. It's not something that you can just take on and just have or just decide you want to do. It's got, for me personally, I believe it's got to be in you. You can't just decide next week, oh, do you know what? I've seen that Instagram post. Entrepreneurship looks quite sick. I'm going to try it out. Yeah, try it out. And when things are not going to plan and the stress is on you and the pressure's on you, you got to realize there isn't a paycheck coming for you at the end of the month if you haven't created nothing, if you haven't worked your socks off, if you haven't created something out of nothing. There's no paycheck coming for you. So you have to make that happen yourself, and you've got to motivate a team. You've got to pull different strings. And at the beginning, you have to wear different hats that potentially you're not very good at. So you've got to find a way to be good at it. Like for me, I knew I wasn't good at talking. I was never good at talking. So I knew that I had to get someone to talk for me. Yeah, I might dictate word for word what they say in a meeting or over the phone, but I had to get someone to do that. So I knew that I had to build a team. And at the beginning, when you're trying to hire people and you've got something holding you back and you feel like your employees do not respect you and all these different things that are going on in your mind and you're still trying to run a business at the same time, it can be very tough. It can be very, very tough. Financial pressures, there's so many pressures that are only relieved once you hit a certain mark. And me and Steph are not even at that mark yet, and we're 3 years in. So it's definitely not as glamorous as everyone makes out, especially at the start as well.
Where did the idea of expanding the horizons of the podcast come from?
Well, you know, I did season one, recorded that, really enjoyed it. But there was no real theme with season one. It was sort of a mixed bag in the terms of guests and their stories. You know, it was obviously very good. But I was thinking, what can I actually do to get things more concise, maybe? So I thought, you know, what actually matters to me? And obviously, I'm a male and mental health. And I thought that's something that's not talked about at all. So if I could focus on maybe the masculinity and mental health audience, that'd be really good. As I'm in a lot of podcast groups, and there's always a lot about women and empowering women podcast, but I thought I haven't seen many about men for male-based podcasts. So I thought maybe I could step into something, try and get a range of guests. Obviously, some people who still stuck there, some people with stories, some who are celebrities being on TV. And it all came by chance again. I had a chance encounter with Mark Coleman at MBE, who's a Paralympic cyclist. And he's become a good friend of mine. He's helped me out a lot. And it's been, again, like I said, it's about taking the opportunities. And I was taking these opportunities. And yeah, season two has gone beyond my wildest expectations again. As some of the people I've interviewed, I've switched the camera off after the interview, shut my laptop down, and thought, how have I managed that? In the space of not even 12 months, I've gone from not wanting to speak, avoiding all speaking situations, stuttering badly in most situations, whether that was with family, friends, strangers, to interviewing people like Colin Jackson, the CBE, and comedian Dane Baptiste. And it's people like that thinking, how have I interviewed Dane Baptiste? I've watched him on 8 out of 10 Cats and Live at the Apollo and Mock the Week. And now I speak to him on social media, I've interviewed him. And yeah, the words aren't there. I don't have the words for what's happened, really.
That's a never-ending dream for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's nice to have that urge to keep going, keep interviewing, keep meeting all these different people. And yeah, it's all going really well. What I've always said is, even if my episodes don't talk about mental health as such, or in those words, or talk about struggles and hardships, just by having two men, two blokes having that open and honest conversation, that's what really matters. You know, just encouraging men just to talk about anything, as that can really help. But I've learned quite a lot, like particularly when I interviewed Mark Ormerod, who was a former Royal Marine, who lost three limbs, and he's the only triple amputee to survive the Afghan conflict. Having the honour to interview him was incredible, as that was someone who was on my wish list, who I thought, no, I'm not going to be able to get Mark Ormerod on the show, but I did. And it's all about mental resilience. It's all about how you view yourself, how other people view you. As I did an interview with an Australian who was addicted to drugs, and he said that even though he's been clean for 3 years, he will always see himself as an addict. He'll always see himself as a drug addict until the day he dies. And I spoke to other people who have similar stories, not so much to do with the drugs, but they don't see themselves as alcoholics anymore. So it's really taught me that your perspective of yourself is ultimately the only thing that matters, and that's how other people will see you if that's how you see yourself, which is quite a deep message, really.
Obviously, you become more self-conscious about stuttering, start to avoid situations where you've got to speak in class. So I used to, when the teacher made people read, I would take tactical toilet breaks, like maybe three people before, or pretend to sneeze. And I think I thought at the time that I was a good actor, but probably the teacher also knew as well, and just allowed me to skip the reading. And I think eventually, as I got older, I would speak to the teachers at the start of the year, and I would say, hey, like, I've got speech impediment, so can you please exclude me from the class reading? Because I used to feel really stressed out in those moments, so I couldn't really concentrate. And it actually affected like the subjects I would choose as you progress through school. Oh. Yeah, so I end up choosing like things like chemistry and math and stuff like that. But it would have been nice to actually do something like history that I was really, really interested in. But that involved obviously quite a bit of reading out loud. And for me, that was a red zone. Then same thing carried on, went to university as well. But along that way, I was involved in sports, and I was quite vocal on the football pitch. So I did have that inner sense of trying to express myself and taking responsibility. So I started to do a bit of that when I was in university with football, taking charge of teams, ended up taking roles in society. So I became at one point a vice president and the next year treasurer of Shaolin Kung Fu Society. So I got into martial arts at that time. That led me to Thai boxing, which I did for about 8 years. And then, yeah, so this pattern carried on, really. But I had a real turning point, actually, when I was 22 and my grandma passed away. So she brought me up. So she came over with my granddad when I was 2 weeks or a week old or something. So she brought me up while my parents worked, and she passed away. And that really hit me hard, to a point where I remember when I found out the news, I couldn't say a word. I tried to, so at that point I was doing a placement. So I went to tell my colleague that I have to leave and go to the hospital, but I couldn't actually speak. So I literally had to get some paper and write down what happened, because I was in so much shock that not a single sound came out for the next 3-4 hours. Like every point I was trying to speak on the way to the hospital, I could not get a single sound out. Like, that whole period was quite tough. Then when it came to the funeral in front of 100, 150 people, I tried to give a speech, but the same thing happened. And I was 22 years old, but I just burst into tears in front of everyone. And I think that was a turning point where, because I felt like the speech had been an obstacle for so long, but it had let me down at too many key moments. So that's when I started to actually think, all right, so I've got to change a few things now. I finished off the placement that I was on, and I literally had like a blank slate. I saved up all of the money I earned and spent the next few months traveling. First trip was two and a half months in Thailand. Thai boxing, and there just wanted to go somewhere completely different, immerse myself in the culture, and enjoyed it, grew a lot, then went a few other places the following year.
And that's it. Thank you very much for listening to episode 12 of season 1, the season finale and best bits. I really enjoyed going through the old episodes and picking out the highlights, and I hope you enjoyed listening to some snippets of those conversations and hopefully gain something from it or just enjoy the listen. I will be back in spring, so I will put out an announcement in March. Until then, let's cross our fingers and get through the next few months. It's pretty tough out there at the moment with the new variant, etc., but let's stay safe. It's a good time to work on your personal projects. So if you are thinking about doing a podcast or anything, this could be the best time. And it would be a good use of time as well. So if you have any questions around that, feel free to message me or questions about the podcast. I'll be more than happy to help. Thank you very much for listening on and supporting. It's been amazing. That's all from me, Ruben Pillai, host of the Underdog Way podcast. See you in season 2.